Hello and welcome to Everyday Oral Surgery. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. I am an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado. The goal of this podcast is to connect, learn, and inspire. In this podcast, you'll be hearing from OMS surgeons all over the globe discussing ways to improve the practice of oral and maxillofacial surgery. Most information shared in this podcast will be based on personal experience and opinions, so please supplement what you learn here with approved research studies. If you are a regular follower of the podcast, please go to our website, everydayoralsurgery.com, and register to receive newsletters and find links to our social media accounts. Most importantly, if you would like to be interviewed on the podcast or know someone who you'd like to hear from, or if there's a topic you'd like to hear about, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. Welcome to another episode. Today I'm with Dr. Dallin Mill. He's a physician anesthesiologist. He is based out of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Dallin, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to join you. I came across your podcast just a couple months ago. It's really helped me kind of understand what keeps you all up at night. So hopefully helping me become a better anesthesia partner in the OR and also in the office.
Yeah, this is great. I really appreciate you reaching out and being willing to discuss some anesthetic type topics with us. Always a really important and well-liked topic for our listeners. Most of our listeners, you know, at least from the email feedback and things I have, are oral maxillofacial surgery residents. Some are dental students. A lot are private practice surgeons. And then we also just have a gamut of other types of, you know, physicians and doctors listening. So hopefully this can be of benefit to a lot of different listeners. Can you start by just kind of giving us a brief history of your training and your current practice setup?
Yeah, thank you. So I did medical school in Chicago at Loyola. After finishing medical school, I went to New Haven, Connecticut, did my anesthesia residency at Yale, and actually met one of your co-dental students from UCLA out there. So we're friends with the people that you know. After I finished my anesthesia training, I did a cardiac anesthesia fellowship at University of Iowa, and it was technically an adult cardiac fellowship. But at the time, University of Iowa didn't have a pediatric anesthesia fellowship. So I was able to do all the pediatric hearts as well, which was really fantastic experience to get during an adult cardiac anesthesia fellowship. And I've been in Colorado Springs in private practice for just over 10 years. I do cardiac, I do OB, I do really everything, neuro, but then also doing anesthesia, in-office anesthesia as well, primarily for oral surgery and pediatric dentistry, helping out. And I started doing that about a year and a half. So finding your podcast has been really a great resource for me. So I'm glad I found you.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You're the first kind of physician anesthesiologist on the podcast. So this is super exciting for us. So I think it's fair to say that most oral maxillofacial surgeons who are, you know, doing cases in their office, you know, implant cases and third molars are probably using a combination of Versed, ketamine, propofol, plus or minus fentanyl, that type of a thing. Usually those are the four drugs I feel like the vast majority of the people on the podcast mention, on my friends talk about. So we were hoping you could talk a little bit about some alternative type medications that, you know, may or may not be of use to us. What all do you use that is could be an alternative to those?
Yeah, so there's a few medications that I want to talk about. And I know that, you know, for some of your listeners, they're not going to be particularly familiar medications. But for others, I know are probably expert and are using these medications regularly. And I'd love to hear back from you if just curious how people are using these in the office, if there's things that have worked well for people. The medication that I want to start talking about is medication dexamethasone. The trade name of that medication is Precedex. And just to give you a little background of the mechanism of action, how that medication works, I think it's useful to think, just kind of refresh our memory about the autonomic nervous system and specifically the sympathetic nervous system. And if you remember back, really the key adrenergic receptors on the sympathetic side, your alpha-1 vasoconstriction, beta-1, that's going to increase chronotropy, inotropy, so your heart rate, the squeezing of your heart, also beta 2 receptor, and that's going to help get oxygen where it needs to be to skeletal muscle, opening up the lungs, relaxing that smooth muscle. And all of those receptors are postsynaptic, and that's helping you in that kind of fight or flight response. So the alpha 2 receptor is unique in that it's on the presynaptic membrane. So its role is really a negative feedback to prevent that fight or flight response from getting out of control. So as that norepinephrine epi fills that synapse, stimulating all of those receptors, it's also hitting that alpha 2 receptor and kind of cooling things off. And so at Precedex, it specifically targets that receptor. There's other medications. Clonidine is another medication, used to be used fairly regularly for blood pressure control. Not so much anymore. You do see it used for chronic pain and some other applications. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But Precedex is 7-8 times more specific to that alpha 2 receptor than clonidine. It's a very clean, very specific medication. So some other properties of that medication. So it's amnestic, so it's a hypnotic. It's anxiolytic. It's also unique in that it's analgesic as well. And there's really ketamine, I guess, would fall into that category, but you don't typically think of your hypnotics as having analgesic properties, and sympatholytic, obviously. Specifically talking about its amnestic properties, in my experience, it's less predictable than, say, propofol or Versed. It's kind of harder to really distinguish when that patient is becoming amnestic and no longer forming memory. It also isn't quite as fast at getting there. So you get Versed and your effect is fairly rapid. Same thing with propofol. So it's a little less predictable in terms of its amnestic or hypnotic properties. And specifically about its analgesic properties, you're not going to find a chart that tells you it's morphine equivalent like you would for other opioids or NSAIDs that, you know, they can give you an idea about how potent that is compared to morphine. Generally, when you hear it described, it's talking about opioid sparing effect. So a lot of the studies will say this was administered as an infusion intraop, or so many mics were given, micrograms were given, and it decreased morphine requirement after this painful surgery, whether spine surgery, or whatever the procedure may be. So it's really talked about in terms of opioid sparing effect. And just to give you an antidote, in my experience with that, I took care of a patient that was having a redo multi-level lumbar spine fusion. Big case, gentleman was in his late 50s, early 60s. He was taking over 200 milligrams of morphine equivalent oxycodone a day. And he had been on that regimen for years. So obviously we were concerned about controlling his pain after that big surgical procedure. And so Precedex was part of that. We included a Precedex infusion during the surgery and then continued that infusion for a couple of days in the post-op as well. And what was interesting is that his opioid requirement post-op was actually less than what it was pre-op. He was taking less than 200 milligrams morphine equivalent post-op day one. And he got some ketamine, he was getting some Tylenol, some other things. So it was a multimodal approach. But certainly that Precedex contributed in decreasing his opioid requirement post-op. Also, it's a unique anesthetic. It's sometimes called a cooperative sedative or cooperative sedation. And so if I'm giving you that medication, your eyes are closed, you're sleeping, and then I say, Grant, open your eyes, and you open your eyes, and you follow commands. So it's a very unique in that respect. And we use that medication for awake craniotomies. So in a patient that's having a brain tumor removed, we'll get the patient sleepy. They'll anesthetize the scalp, open the vault. Then we sort of wake the patient back up and they're communicating with the patient, have a psychologist in the room communicating with the patient, making sure that the surgeon isn't affecting critical parts of the brain as they're removing that. And that Precedex really allows us to do that, to communicate with a patient that's having a major surgery. Also, carotid surgery, awake intubation is another application of the medication as well. And another really valuable part of this medication profile is it decreases agitation. So particularly with children or teenagers, when I administer this medication intraop, emergence delirium is much less common. So these patients wake up more calm and the recovery is generally smoother. There's also a lot of data on cardiac patients. So I use this for my heart patients that are going to the ICU after open heart surgery. And we run that infusion and it helps with a more calm, smooth wake up. And if it helps us avoid other medications like benzodiazepines, even propofol, postoperative delirium in those older patients is improved. So overall cognitive function with this medication is better. And that's what you see. You see that they're asleep, but when they're awake, they're clear, they're responsive. Unlike what you see with ketamine, benzodiazepines, and even propofol, just much more clear and awake. Also, another benefit of this medication, it's generally thought to be medication that does not cause respiratory suppression. So another big benefit at higher doses and when you're co-administering it with other medications, it can absolutely contribute to respiratory suppression. So you have to be cognizant of that. Even though it has this reputation for not affecting the respiratory drive, it definitely can at higher doses and in combination with medications. You know, you talk about all that. This sounds like the perfect sedative. It's going to be perfect. We just turn it on. Patient's asleep. They're following commands. It's controlling their pain, you know, removing those wisdom teeth, whatever the case may, whatever you're doing. But unfortunately, as we know, there's really no perfect anesthetic and Precedex is no different. And I talked a little bit about that, that it's quite a bit less predictable in terms of getting to an appropriate level of sedation. It takes a little bit longer. And there's some side effects that we need to consider in using this medication as well. And as you could guess, if we're affecting that negative feedback loop in the sympathetic nervous system and you're cooling off the sympathetic response, bradycardia, hypotension, it just makes sense that those are going to be two side effects of this medication. And you definitely see that. And even in relatively small doses, you're going to see a decrease in the heart rate shortly after administration. And the blood pressure is going to come down. And it's actually bimodal. It's kind of interesting that initially when you're giving the medication, you see a bump in the blood pressure. But then as you continue to give that medication, then you start to see that blood pressure sag later on. So in general, decreased heart rate, decreased blood pressure with the medication. There are some case reports of pretty profound bradycardia and even asystole. Generally, that's with patients that already have underlying cardiac disease, whether they have conduction abnormalities or other issues, and with dosing errors. So this is a medication that's given micrograms. If inadvertently a larger dose is given, that's generally where we've seen really significant complications with bradycardia.
Well, that is interesting. Just to interject, because it sounds like if it's a hypnotic and anxiolytic drug and analgesic, it sounds like it's prop, ketamine, and Versed all wrapped into one drug. And I think from what I've heard, I know several oral maxillofacial surgeons have kind of navigated it and use it pretty consistently. But it seems like what you're saying is that the rate of onset's longer, and that's kind of a prohibiting thing for, or at least discouraging thing for oral surgeons who are trying to do cases a little quicker. I mean, is the rate of onset pretty significant when you compare it to Versed and Prop? Or
the way that the package insert would tell you to administer it is initially with a bolus administered over a microgram per kilo, bolus administered over 10 minutes. And by the end of that bolus, people are starting to feel, you can tell that it's starting to affect the patient. And then you follow that up with an continued infusion. So really, that's kind of what you're looking at. You're kind of looking at this 10-minute time frame. So that doesn't really fit into a fast turnover practice where you're doing a bunch of quick third molars and moving people through the office fairly quickly. And again, that the unpredictability. But really, it's for me, the reason that I've gotten away from giving it routinely is the drowsiness post-op. So propofol, other medications, you know, seem that once they wear off, it's just a little more predictable waking up. So you can definitely have some patients that are very sleepy post-op if they've also received that Precedex. So that for me has been the limiting factor, really wanting people to be awake and ready to leave the office. So really the way that I primarily use it, there's really kind of three applications. So intraop, The patients that I do give it to routinely are chronic pain patients, patients that are on a lot of opioids, patients that have a ton of anxiety, that, you know, they're just really amped up when they get in the office. And you can kind of just anticipate that they're going to have a similar demeanor when they're waking up. I feel like that is going to impair their discharge more than being sleepy. Those are the patients that I'll just give it to routinely. Also, patients that are drug users, whether it's methamphetamine or if daily heavy marijuana users, I think that it helps with their wake up. Also, alcohol, if patients are daily heavy alcohol drinkers, definitely beneficial in those patients from my experience. And then you also have the kind of the teenage boys that seems tend to have propensity to have a more wild wake up. So if, depending on what their demeanor is pre-op, I will work in some medication. And the way that I give it, generally, it's about 10 to 40 micrograms. And I try to get it in really early. So even in a procedure that's going to be an hour, 2 hours, even 3 hours, I try to work in that medication early on. And it seems to give you the benefit of that kind of calmness as they're waking up without prolonging the wake up. If I give it at the end of the case, it just seems like they're more sleepy. So I want them to be more awake, but still get the benefit of just that kind of calming effect of the medication. That's the patient population that I'll give it to routinely. The other application is really kind of a rescue medication in PACU or in recovery. So they're waking up, they're really agitated. So I'll work in, give 5 micrograms, another 5, and repeat that every couple minutes until it's kind of helped them calm down. And I had a patient recently in the office, heavy drinker, and woke up really agitated. It was about 5 hours of anesthesia. And I just worked in that Precedex, about 40 micrograms, really allowed him to calm down and get the prosthesis fitting. So really beneficial in that. There's another application as a preoperative sedative for children. It can be given intranasal. So it's kind of nice without IV access. You can give it intranasal, and it can help that child be more calm for the procedure. But again, it takes time. So that has to get in pretty quick. It's going to be at least 10 minutes, more like 20 minutes before you start to see that effect. And that's 1 to 2 mics per kilogram injected nasally. I think you really, to make it work well, beneficial to have the atomizer or the little device that creates a fine mist. So you're really covering as much of the mucosa as possible, not just squirting it in with a syringe where you're losing a lot of the medication. I personally haven't needed to use that very regularly, but it does work. But again, it takes some time. When I was in training, the limiting factor with Precedex was cost. It was very expensive. It's since become generic. And I just looked at my pricing, and it's less than $3 a vial. So that's 2 ml vial, has 200 mics. If I'm giving 10 to 20 to 40 micrograms, so you could fraction it out if you're preparing that before the beginning of the day and just have some syringes available, you can really stretch that out, and it's very cost effective.
I wonder if there's any described protocol where, you know, you would give the Precedex kind of at the beginning, maybe with some prop or Versed, not so much for its initial effect, but for the, like you're saying, the wake up, if you do have a patient who's super high anxiety, you know, they're using marijuana every day and you're kind of high suspect for a hard wake up. Have you tried anything like that?
Those are the exact patient population where I will give it just routinely at the beginning. Whether it's a general where I'm intubating the patient, or even with the sedation, working that in early, seeing that benefit. And I think that way you give it at the beginning, it does kind of smooth out the anesthetic as well. You're getting the analgesic benefit. So if you are finding areas that maybe weren't quite blocked as well as, you know, you find a hot spot, that it kind of smooths some of that stuff out if you give it up front. And then again, avoids that excessive sleepiness in the recovery period.
I would say it seems like 50% of my teenagers for wisdom teeth are like smoking marijuana every day. I mean, it's probably an exaggeration. Maybe it's 20 or 30% here in Colorado, but I mean, it's a lot. I mean, a lot of anxious teenagers. I see it more in the, seems like the female patients that have the hard wake up and crying and just like, you know, a long recovery, and parents are always worried, like, what's wrong? Are they in pain? And, you know, that type of thing. And so I could see this being a very useful medication to smooth out some of that.
Yep. And that's been my experience too, that not only the, you know, waking up swinging and agitated, also I think it can be beneficial in that other picture that you just described, the emotional and crying. And I think it can be beneficial there as well.
Excellent. Well, that's helpful. Any other comments on that one?
We covered most of what I wanted to talk about with dexmedetomidine. And another medication I want to talk about is remifentanil. Ultiva is the trade name of that medication. And I know that it's becoming much more prevalent in the oral surgery world, I think, is my impression that more people are using it. But I just want to talk to you a little bit about my experience from the operating room and also from the office and how it's helped my practice. Also want to talk about, obviously, some of the things to be aware of if it's something you're thinking about introducing into your practice. So what's unique about remifentanil is it's extremely short-acting. And just to give you an idea of how short-acting it is in terms of its context-sensitive half-time. And just to remind you, when administering an infusion of a medication, what the context-sensitive half-time describes is that once you stop that infusion, how long does it take the plasma level to decrease by half? So to get to 50%. And most medications, the longer you run that infusion, the longer it's going to take to get back to 50%. And really what that's helping you or describing for us is that the human body is really a number of compartments in terms of pharmacology. So you administer to the bloodstream, and that medication enters the plasma. So you have this higher concentration in the plasma, then you're going to spill over into these other compartments, the interstitial space, the fat, the intercellular fluid, all of those other compartments. The longer you run that medication, the more those other compartments are going to fill up. When I stop that medication, now I'm inverting my gradient. Those medications, as the medication is eliminated out of the bloodstream, those medications are going to start to come and reverse and pour back into the plasma from those other compartments. So to just give you an idea, if I run an infusion of remifentanil for an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours, even longer, when I turn that off, you're going to be back down to 50%. You're going to have a 50% decrease in your plasma concentration in under 5 minutes. In comparison, if you think about fentanyl, and fentanyl is a little bit different. It's a unique in the way that it fills other spaces, and its context-sensitive half-time is a little bit unique. But an hour infusion of fentanyl, I turn that off, it's going to take 20, 30 minutes to decrease 50%. If I run it for 2 hours, it's going to take an hour. If I run it for 5 hours and turn off that infusion, it's going to take over 3 hours for fentanyl's concentration to come down to 50%. So that is truly remarkable that remifentanil is so ultra short acting that in under 5 minutes, you're already at 50, it's on its way out. So that's really what makes it so useful in the operative setting, is that it's not only short acting, its onset is very rapid and it's a very potent analgesia. So it really decreases. And I think its real value is that how much it decreases the other anesthetics that you have to give to keep your surgical field optimized. I think it's important to talk about why it's so short acting. And the reason it's so short acting is that it's metabolized directly in the plasma by esterases. So as an ester bond, that ester bond is cleaved, it's eliminated. And it's part of this bigger class of drug called soft drug. So not only is it rapidly metabolized, its metabolites are very inactive. So some other examples of medications that fall into the kind of this class of medications, succinylcholine is one. Succinylcholine is two acetylcholine molecules bound together by an ester bond. So that ester bond is broken very rapidly in the bloodstream. Succinylcholine's duration of action is extremely short because of that. There's beta blocker, esmolol, another example, also broken down by esterases. So it's a very short acting beta blocker, which is very useful in controlling the times that I use it as an induction. So I can get a patient off to sleep, intubate them, and control their heart rate to avoid, you know, decrease the risk of ischemia from tachycardia by giving esmolol without giving a bunch of opioid. I don't need opioid to control that heart rate because of esomelol, but it's forgiving in that it wears off quickly. And as the anesthetic kicks in, the tendency is just get heart rate come down. They get hypotensive. If I'm using other agents to control that initial sympathetic surge with induction. So esomelol allows me to do that. So you have this beta blocker. Clavitipine is another one. It's a calcium channel blocker. So it's very similar to nicardipine. Very useful intraoperatively to control blood pressure and very forgiving. When you stop giving it, it wears off. Remimazolam, the benzodiazepine, we'll talk about that a little bit later. Another example. So just this class of medication for us is so useful that Remi falls into in the very dynamic environment that surgery is. Grant, I'll ask you, have you used remifentanil or is it a medication that you've had an opportunity to experiment with or use in your practice?
Hey guys, real quick, KLS Martin is offering a 35% discount on my favorite KLS Martin instruments for everyday oral surgery listeners. So there's a link in the podcast notes with a full listing and a video highlighting some of the advantages of using KLS Martin instrumentation. To utilize this offer, use promo code STUCKYFAVES with a capital S and a capital F. So capital S, lowercase T-U-C-K-I, capital F, lowercase A-V-S. And you can use that through your KLS Martin sales rep or by emailing usa@klsmartin.com. I handpicked these instruments based on the kind of favorite extraction instruments that I use on a daily basis. And I hope you enjoy them. Not a lot. I'll say that. I used it in my anesthesia, you know, training in residency several times. We used it in the OR when I was on my anesthesia rotation for retrobulbar blocks. We would do the Remy waltz was there, the way they described it. And then we also used it just for oral surgery, third molar sedation cases. It was like a Remy probe mix and fusion. It was one of our, you know, attendings like to use that. So yeah, some experience there, and seemed like a great drug. It sounds like similar to Presidex in that, maybe even more so, but it's just like very small doses and it's so potent that you have to be very careful with how much you're giving and who's drawing it up and knowing all those numbers and stuff.
Definitely. Yep. So want to become familiar with it and really respect the medication, definitely, as you start to use it or before you start using it. And that prop-remi combination that you mentioned is how I use it. I include that remifentanil in the propofol, and it can really cut in half the amount of propofol I need to keep a patient asleep. The longer I practice anesthesia, the cleaner and more simple I want my anesthetic to be. If I could just give light propofol to everybody, wake them up at the end, I would do that because I think it's such a nice medication. Patients feel good. It doesn't cause nausea. And really what the remifentanil addition allows you to do is to do a low dose propofol infusion, and then remifentanil is out of the system. It really provides me with a lot of comfort knowing, you know, for patients that are obese or have sleep apnea, I don't really want to give those patients a lot of opioid, particularly in the office. So the remifentanil provides a really smooth anesthetic, and then it's gone. And I know Dr. Bosak out in Chicago, he described that. I saw his talk from Amos in 2008, and that's a good resource to look at his talk from 2018. He talks about his mixture of how many mics he's adding with the propofol and how he's administering it. I'd say that I use a little bit lower dose of remifentanil than what he described. The 125 mics in 200 milligrams is what he's using at least at that time, and running it at about 70 mics per kilogram per minute. So I use a little bit less remifentanil than that, but that is a great combination. So some of the things to be aware of. So just like any opioid, it can cause facial itching. And so you'll notice that when you turn it off and the patient's waking up and there's still some remifentanil floating around, it can be pretty profound. So as they wake up, just itching, can't keep their hands off their face. They just have to scratch their face. So you really want to be careful of protecting their eyes, make sure they're not scratching their cornea as that remifentanil is completely getting off, but it's generally short-lived. So once that is completely metabolized, it just seems to go away. Nausea can cause nausea, but actually, and I was looking at a couple studies, and this has been my experience, that it doesn't cause nausea to the degree that other medications do. And it generally resolves once that remifentanil has been completely metabolized. So I think it's favorable from that perspective. It's really helping you avoid the opioids that are going to stick around a long time and cause the nausea. Also shivering, I generally see that in younger patients. And they could even be during the procedure, they're asleep, they're not really responding, they're not moving other than getting some rigors and really shaking. Is really that remifentanil causing that. And you can see that when they wake up. I found that keeping the patients warm is really beneficial. In the operating room, obviously, we have a bear hugger. It's blowing that warm air on them. That's great. In the office, making sure that you have blankets available and making sure that, you know, you're doing everything you can to maintain their core temperature can help with that as well. Bradycardia, that's another one. It can be also profound. And I've had a couple earlier in my career, and really in residency and early career, a couple of inadvertent boluses that were given. And how that tends to happen is that sometimes if you're infusing that medication higher up in IV tubing, it starts to accumulate, and it accumulates in that carrier line. And then you open up the fluids to give a bolus, or you push another medication. Now you have this big column of pretty concentrated remifentanil that all hits at once. And I've seen, you know, the heart rate go from cruising in the 60s, 70s, and now it's 30. That's only happened a couple of times, but it's just, you have to be aware that that's a possibility of that building up. So really avoiding boluses. And then again, when you're measuring that medication, make sure you're not rushed. Make sure you know exactly how many micrograms you're adding to your propofol, however you're administering it. You really have to eliminate the dosing errors. There's another thing to be aware of, chest wall rigidity that we talk about. And for me, chest wall rigidity, when I read the literature, it's murky. I have a hard time really weeding through. So much of it is anecdotal. There are some good studies from the 80s that actually looked at the causes of that. And there does appear to be EMG activity. So receiving opioids causes muscle activity. And that's been pretty well documented. But I think a lot of the case reports, the anecdotal stuff that we hear, it's hard for me to tell. Is that just run-of-the-mill laryngospasm? Is that bronchospasm? Is that just challenges with bag mask technique of the provider? It's hard to tell exactly what's happening. One of the podcast episodes that I listened to, I'm trying to remember when that was, Dr. Heckler, I think, back in October of last year, you talked about a closed claims case of a 12-year-old that was having propremi infusion sedation. And I remember when you introduced that topic and that case, my very first question that popped into my mind was, there a definitive airway? And it sounds like that was an open airway case. And it sounds like there was an anesthesia provider there that was administering it. But I personally, I know that Dr. Bozak and his description, he doing that with an open airway, and he's perfected the technique clearly. I know that there's others that have. For me personally, I just really am more comfortable with that breathing tube being there for all of these reasons that we described, the bradycardia, but this chest wall, you know, you get a little tickle on the vocal cords and now you're having a hard time ventilating, or I really am comfortable having that breathing tube there. I can feel what the chest, you know, the lung compliance changes in the lung compliance. And if there was some chest wall rigidity, I've already have the solution. The tube's there. I can muscle relax. I can increase the depth of my anesthetic, whatever I need to do to overcome that. I think the other piece there is hypercarbia. And in general, in younger patients, hypercarbia is very well tolerated. Carbon dioxide levels can get very high and it's okay. But I think it's important to remember that oxygenation does not equal ventilation. And studies on that, this passive flow of oxygen is your body takes up that oxygen out of the lungs. It creates concentration gradient that encourages that oxygen to flow down into the alveoli, continue that process of pulling up into the lungs. That does not necessarily mean that you're ventilating. Those carbon dioxide levels can get high. And I think just being cognizant of that, particularly in older patients, really high carbon dioxide levels. You can see bradycardia, hypotension, really severe acidosis. And in those patients, you know, vasoactive medications, if hypotension does become a problem and their pH is 7, not as responsive to those vasoactive medications. So, and I see that when you're using that propremi infusion, the respiratory rate can be six to 10 is kind of where it seems like the respiratory rate likes to settle out, because that opioid effect, generally you're getting larger tidal volumes. So your minute ventilation is higher than what you would expect generally when you do have that 6 to 10 breaths per minute, but just being aware of that. I think another important entity to be aware of is pulmonary hypertension. So if you have patients with pulmonary hypertension and you give them a medication that causes their CO2 to increase, that acidosis, that hypercarbia can cause that pulmonary hypertension to increase and contribute to right heart failure. So if you have a patient that falls into that category, I want to be able to control their CO2 levels. So having that breathing tube there, allowing me to do that. And really knowing what that end tidal CO2 is with the nasal cannula, it's good to know just to see their respiratory rate, see them exhaling, but you really don't know what their end tidal CO2 is. And by extension, you don't know what their PaCO2 is without that breathing tube. But fantastic medication. I use it all the time. Excellent drug for sure. Cost is an issue. So last I checked, a milligram was about $75 for a milligram vial. And also it's a powder, so you have to constitute it. So you have to dilute it. And so another area for making potential error in constituting that medication.
Well, that's a good take-home message of, you know, hearing all the pros and cons of it. And that's my experience too, is that, you know, I wouldn't use that without a secured airway breathing tube in place, because I've seen some of these things happen. I had a similar thing when I was on anesthesia, where we were doing the retrobulbar block with the Remy, and we were kind of doing micro boluses. And like right in the middle of doing that, the patient like bent her hand and like the IV was there and it stopped the IV, and we didn't realize it for a couple seconds. And then, oh shoot, the patient's not dripping, straighten her hand out. And then boom, it all shoots
doubled
in.
Up. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of a few seconds of, you know, her jaw clamping down and acting rigid and some scary stuff, you know, going on. But yeah, so.
And I was going to say too, before we left that conversation, I just really am glad that you do those closed claims reviews, that you do case reviews on the podcast. I think in terms of patient safety, there's really no other exercise that can compare in value to those conversations, to talk about those really rare events where you're going to see, you know, that complication. Usually everything goes great. Everything's fine. You know, we get away with a lot of stuff. So to have that conversation about that event and to think through that and have that thought process, it keeps us vigilant. We learn from each other's mistakes. When that rare event happens to you, you're much more prepared. I want to just commend you for doing that. And I hope that continues. So I'll look forward to listening to more of those conversations.
Yeah, that's some good feedback. I appreciate you saying that. But because those topics, I personally, that's how I learned the most, is hearing those complications and in a story format. Is just like, it burns into my brain. I never forget that stuff. I'll have to hear it in once, like a story like that. It's hard to get those stories and it's hard to share. And it's, you know, a lot of people feel uncomfortable talking about that stuff. And I think it's good to do that in a setting, you know, that's safe and that everyone can learn from, because that's the goal, is just let's learn together here. Real quick too, I was going to say, I had a question. Sorry to jump back to Precedex, but let's say wisdom tooth case. It's, you're planning on it being 20 minutes intra-op actual surgical time, and then another 20, 30 minutes to recover. So we're sitting in the room for maybe 45 minutes to an hour. If I was going to give, you know, 5 milligrams Versed and 25 milligrams Prop at the beginning, what would be a good dose of Precedex to give at the beginning to smooth out their recovery at the end?
Yeah, that's a great question. And obviously, depends on patient's age. I think most of your patients are going to be younger, so it's going to be pretty well tolerated. And I would just start with 10 mics. Just give 10 micrograms and see what your experience is with that. Just try it on a handful of patients, bump it up to 20. I think that for your patient population, for your, in combination with the other medications that you're routinely giving, pretty quickly you'll get an idea of how much is too much.
Okay.
So I think 10 mics and just see how that affects your anesthetic and go up from there.
Excellent. That's super helpful. Well, that's a good review. I think, you know, great couple of drugs that have a lot of application, you know, in oral surgery. I know a lot of colleagues who use these. Actually, my attending who was doing the Remy Pro infusion was Bob Bozak.
Okay, residency. There you go.
Yeah, he was the one who's like, this is what we're doing. No other attending did that. And so it was great to learn from him.
I would love to go into his operating room and just see how he manages that. It'd be really helpful. It is a small world. We were just talking about that before we got on the podcast. And I will say about the Precedex, something that may be useful. I generally, when I dilute it, I just put that one vial, which is 200 micrograms, and inject it into a 100 ml bag of normal saline. So then you have a bag that's 2 mics per ml. So you drop a 10 ml syringe, there's 20 mics. And so I think that would be a good place to start. If you do start to use it for those third molars, given that kind of 10 to 20 mics and just see how patients are doing. So that's a really easy way to prepare it.
And then you were just mentioning some kind of pediatric techniques that maybe don't involve pharmaceutical medications. Can you just touch on that briefly?
A year and a half ago, I was in the airport, the Portland airport, waiting for my flight to come back to Denver. My 84-year-old father graduated from University of Oregon in 1964. He hadn't been back to campus since. So I thought it'd be fun to take a trip out there and watch a football game. So I was in the airport. I was just reading the Wall Street Journal on my phone and came across an article by Megan Cox Gurdon. And she's the children's literature critic for the Wall Street Journal. And she had this article in the op-ed section called "Reading Aloud Can Remedy COVID Learning Loss," elementary age kids. And so I was interested in the article, and I read that article, and she talks about the power of reading to kids out loud. And she has a book called The Enchanted Hour. So I had a flight to get on and some time to wait in the airport there. So I downloaded the audiobook and listened to her audiobook. Great book. I know you like to recommend books at the end of your podcast, so there's one recommendation. But she talks about the science behind it, including functional MRI studies that shows what happens to a child's brain when an adult is reading to them, or anyone's reading to them, but particularly when a parent is reading to the child, and comparing that to what the child's brain does when they're on an iPad. And there's really nothing that improves the child's development, whether it's socially, intellectually. Pretty much every measure is improved by reading to a child out loud. And it's such a cheap, easy thing for us to do. Forms connection. There's so many benefits. So as I'm reading this or listening to that book, thinking, how can I use this in my practice? I thought, I'm going to use it to help kids get off to sleep. And if you've ever been with an anesthesiologist that doing a mask induction, and there's probably some oral surgeons that are doing that as well. Sometimes it goes really smooth and sometimes it doesn't. You know, there aren't a lot of three-year-olds that are willing to walk into a room with all this equipment, all this scary stuff, people wearing masks, busy hospital, busy, you know, waiting room, and hop on a bed and let a stranger in a mask put a mask over their face that smells like a shower curtain and get them off to sleep. And so I just thought, I'm going to use this book. I was experimenting with it, and I really figured out I have my favorite book, The Wish Fish. It came in this, it's just a very simple, small book with great pictures, just a little bit of text. And it's amazing. It's better than pre-op Versed. It's better than anything that I've done. And I would say 95% of the kids that I take care of are the ones that have failed, you know, in the pedo dentist office. So that's why I'm seeing them, because they can't have this done without being totally asleep. So these are the tough ones. And I would say 90, 95% of these kids willingly go off to sleep. Let me put that mask on their face, reading this book to them. And a child, if you've ever read a book to them, they can't help but point. And you say, oh, do you see that fish? What color is that big fish? And they're orange. And where's the special fish? And so it's just this very interactive thing. And I think when you see those kids in the pre-op area, the waiting room, and they're on an iPad, and it's almost like you get back there and there's a book, it's almost novel. they're seeing these pictures and they're interacting. The other beautiful thing about it is that it gives the parent something to do. You know, we'd put these kids to sleep, put the mask on their face. They go through kind of this wiggly phase. Their eyes are rolling. Their breathing gets short and raspy. And mom is just sitting there helpless. But I'm giving mom a job. And I tell the kid, I tell that the child that, okay, mom's job is to read the book to you. My job is to hold this mask. And kids, it just makes sense for kids, I think, that I've got a job. Mom's got a job. All right, let's read this book. And this was early on. I had a three-year-old come in, and apparently in the office, she was just wild. And there's they couldn't do anything in the office. She hops up on the bed in the operating room. And this was actually at a surgery center. Mom was holding the book and holding it up so she could see it. And we started that process. And she was just so into this book. And I put the mask on her face. And it's been about a minute, maybe 90 seconds. And I'm thinking, man, this isn't phasing her. This nitrous, because I usually try to get them a little relaxed with nitrous and then add the sevoflurane that can be a little bit more, doesn't smell as, kind of has a funny smell. And I look over and like, oh, the nitrous isn't even on. So this three-year-old wild patient just let me hold a mask on her face for 90 seconds without any anesthetic and just totally engaged with this book. And I think that was the moment I realized there's something here. So it's magic. I'm usually involved in the kids that really need a deeper level of anesthesia. So I'd love to see how that works in your office. If you have pediatric patients, could you do an exam without sedation? Could you get that x-ray, you know, in the pedo office? Can they get the x-ray with just this holding the book and reading the book with the child technique and avoid anesthetic and avoid coming to see me? If they can avoid it altogether, even better. So if there's any of your people that are listening and try that, please let me know. I would love to hear how it goes in your office. It has totally changed the way I'm able to get kids off to sleep. And I think I've also noticed that when they go to sleep and they're smiling, reading this book, and they're calm and engaged, their wake up is so much better. I just feel like I have way less. I don't need as much Precedex to have them calm in the PACU, the recovery room, because they went to sleep calm and they wake up calm. So it's really been a huge thing for my practice. I'd like to hear anybody else's experience with that.
Yeah, that's cool. That's so genius. I don't know why I haven't thought of that, but definitely something I would like to try. I mean, just describing that, because I have, you know, six kids. My youngest is five. And it is magic when I start reading them a book or whatever it is. They just calm down. Everything seems to melt away.
Slows down. Yeah. If you look at your waiting room, if you take care of pediatric patients, I'd just be curious too that I go into some pediatric office and it's more of an arcade, you know, in the pre-op area. I wonder if it was more of a children's library, would behavior change? You know, if those kids were engaged with books before they came back to you, is there, you know, you encourage mom to read them a book or dad or whoever's with them to read a book with them and see if you see a change in overall behavior. I'd be really interested to learn about that.
Kids even know what a book is these days? No, I'm just kidding. It's just sad.
Sometimes I wonder. I know.
They should. Great technique and good to hear that you're using that effectively. Any other non-pharmaceutical techniques you're using?
There were until this book. Like, seriously, it's like my go-to. Like, I feel like, yeah, I don't see any reason why I would. And that's why I'm not really using the nasal. Absolutely, there are patients that have special needs that, you know, they're unable to engage with the book. So there's still those techniques that you need to use. And occasionally still have to do a ketamine. I am ketamine. But if I can avoid it, great. So
have you tried this book on like older kids? Is it like what age are you using this for?
Yeah. So this book that I use, this Wish Fish, is super simple. I mean, it's like first reader, you know, kids that are just learning to read. This is a book that they would use. It's just the pictures almost that are engaging and kind of telling a story. Like, I have my kind of routine that I go through with this book. I know all the things to point out, the things that engage kids well. But I've used it on older kids too. I mean, 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, and I'll even joke like, hey, I know this book is like for 3-year-olds, but let's look at that. You know, let's check it out. I thought about getting more complex book for older kids, you know, the 10-year-old, 12-year-old, but it's a little bit harder to get into those books. They're a little more complex. I'll even use it on those older kids just as a way to engage them, even though, and just acknowledging that I know this book is way beyond, you're probably reading Harry Potter, but look at this, it's kind of funny. So even for older kids, but definitely that, like, you know, 2 to 6-year-old age range, it is magic. So
we just have a ton of, like, I'd say 8 to 14-year-olds, and some of them are just you know, hysterical type of a thing, and I could see this working even on them. And like what you're saying, where you kind of give a qualifying thing at the beginning and say, this is for little kids, but read it with me, and I could see that calming them down, even just the act of sitting there for a couple minutes reading.
And I think in the waiting room, maybe too, I'd love to see if there's any impact there. If you give them a book, say, hey, if you want to read this book to your child, and, you know, even if they're 8, 9, or let the child read the book, that you just have some, you're sort of suggesting it and see how it helps.
I would like someone to do that before my dental appointments, read that with me. I would call them.
Yeah, seriously. That's not a bad idea.
All right. Well, that's been great. So if you're okay with listeners reaching out, I could maybe put your email in the show notes. And if there's people who have some feedback, I'd love to hear it as well. You could email myself and or Dallin, and it'd be good to hear some feedback. But yeah, that's been invaluable information. I really appreciate you sharing that with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on today.
Excellent. Real quick, I got to ask you the rapid fire questions.
Okay.
What's the best book you've read other than Wish Fish in the last year?
That's tough. I mean, Wish Fish is at the top of that list. So we just, as a family, we just finished Boys in the Boat, which I hadn't read. When I saw the movie coming on, and people had always talked about it, that was a great book. The movie, as they always do, doesn't quite do it justice, but great book. Another book that I thought was fantastic, Genghis Khan. And apparently it's not Genghis, it's Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World. Fantastic book. It's by Weatherford, published in 2004. But I had no idea. I mean, fascinating story that in 25 years, Genghis Khan took over more land and ruled over more people than the Roman Empire. Think about that, what he accomplished. But what's so fascinating was his ruling style, and just a lot of surprises reading that book, how they did it, but then also how he really had a meritocracy, and he really elevated, you know, these people that if they had something to offer his broad empire, then he wanted them to do it. And he gave them the freedom to do that, to whether it was knowledge or goods. And he moved it all over that massive, you know, empire that touched multiple continents. It's a great book.
Did you read or listen to this one?
I listened to that one. And that, I'll be honest, when I sit down, I'm so tired. I have little kids too. I can barely get through a kid's book without falling asleep on the couch. So my commute is how I get through my books. So commute to work every day, and you can, at 2x speed, you can get through a lot of books.
Yes. A pro tip for listening to Audible.
Yep, exactly.
Great. Okay. I just added that to my library because I also listen to a bunch of books on my commute. The next question is, what, you know, non-anesthesia thing do you do in your daily life that helps you with your anesthesia skills?
Skills? Okay. Well, about 6 months ago, I started playing hockey. I had ice skated a couple times, never played hockey. My boys got rollerblades from my two girls that I kind of grew out of them. They're these pink rollerblades. And my two little boys put those skates on there, just like nonstop in the driveway, skating around. So I thought, well, I'll get them a hot. Actually, they made hockey sticks out of, you know, broomsticks and tape and stuff on the bottom of them. So they did that for about a year. So finally, they're like, okay, let's do hockey. And this, where we take our kids to hockey, they have this program. It's called Big Rookies. So it's a bunch of 40-year-olds that have never really skated before getting out and playing hockey. And I just had a game last night. We won 4-2. So that was big. I didn't contribute too much, but I was out on the ice, and it's amazing how tired that gets you. So I think, yeah, just doing stuff like that, wearing yourself out, helps me get back in the OR and get back to the grind. So if you haven't tried hockey, I recommend it.
Please tell me you're not getting like body checked and like thrown on the ground and all this stuff.
Not intentionally, but usually the checking is the result of just me skating out of control. So running into people inadvertently. But I have to say, I played a lot of basketball, and that just, as I got older, you know, you're jamming your thumbs and rolling ankles and getting hit in the face, and it's hard on the knees. Hockey, it's just way less impact. It's actually, I think, much more sustainable than the basketball was going to be. So,
yes, I completely agree. I had to give up basketball a few years as well, a few years ago.
All right. Super fun. Look into hockey.
Okay. Well, I usually ask a question about what's your favorite dental forceps to use for a certain tooth. So, for you,
okay. Well,
for you, it'd be what's your favorite syringe size?
Well, no, I actually do have an answer, and it's the only forceps that I use related to dentistry, and it's the McGill forceps.
There we go.
So there you go. That's the little forceps that I use to, if I need to guide that tube a little bit to get it through the vocal cords. So I do have a forceps.
Totally forgot. Yeah, anesthesiologists do use a forceps. Okay.
Just one.
All right. Favorite movie or TV series? Do you have time to watch shows?
Well, my kids are really, my girls are really into Percy Jackson that just came out. I've seen one of those episodes, but they wait every, they're like Tuesday, next Tuesday, 7 o'clock, the new episode's coming out. They're right there waiting for it. I really liked the Sherlock Holmes series, the BBC with Cumberbatch a few years ago.
I love that. That's good.
I don't watch a lot of series, but that one I really liked, but that's kind of old news. So.
All right. And then last question is, do you have a favorite quote? Just some type of mantra or quote that you find yourself?
Favorite quote. Okay. Well, this is a quote from probably my favorite attending from fellowship, Kenichi Ueda. He's since gone back to Japan. Great guy. And this is kind of going back to the conversation of, we would take care of these kids that, you know, whether they were, a lot of them were 3 months old or a couple years old, and they're coming back for maybe a staged heart procedure for their congenital heart disease. And his big thing was, if the child cries going to sleep, it's a complication. In his mind, that was a complication. And that really, really stuck with me. And he would use these techniques of just being really gentle, using that nitrous, just kind of blowing over their face, distracting, using every technique he could. That kind of stuck to me, or stuck with me. And so hopefully he's proud of me for doing this book thing, and it's helped my kids get off to sleep without tears. So
great technique. And the best part is there's no complications, I would think, to this technique.
Yeah, there's no side effects.
Right.
It's 100% beneficial. Yeah.
Perfect. That's what we love. Well, Dallin, thank you so much for your time today. It's been awesome talking to you. And let's reconnect soon in the future. I appreciate it.
Love to do it. Thank you.
All right. Sounds good. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. For more information on these podcasts, please visit everydayoralsurgery.com. I love feedback and would be very grateful if you would reach out to me via my email, grantstukey@gmail.com, and let me know what you thought of this episode. Or you can text me at 720-441-6059. Additionally, if you have any topics you'd like to hear about, or if you'd like to be a guest on the podcast, please, please email or text me. I found many of my interviewees through people who have been contacting me and have been listening, and I've gotten so many great ideas for more podcasts, and that's what helps keep the podcast rolling. So really appreciate you making that extra effort and helping me out with feedback and knowing what to do next on the podcast. Thank you so much.